Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Today we have a great guest, and this is a guy that I just fell in love with his music. He's in a band called Gray Boy All Stars, and he also is a solo artist, and he does a lot of licensing. He's a super talented guy, great writer, and this isn't the kind of music that's really common, and what they do it really, really well. So with Michael Andrews, a couple of quick messages. I want to thank Kevin Calabro for hooking us up. Thank you very much, Kevin. And also make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. If you're already watching us on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button and the little icon, the little emoji that looks like a bell that helps us with the YouTube algorithms. All righty. Michael Andrews, guitarist, producer, and film score composer. He does not do a lot of interviews, so I'm really happy to have him on the show. He's a founding member and guitarist of the legendary San Diego Boogaloo soul jazz band, the Gray Boy All Stars, where he also goes by the moniker Elgin Park. The band's released 6 incredible funk, groove, acid jazz albums, and that's me putting that word incredible in there, not the PR person. I was blown away. I usually listen to one album, and I want to listen to the whole catalog. This is great stuff. Including their latest and their first album in 7 years called Como de All Stars. Michael's a really good funk and jazz guitarist. He's got a great tone, really unique sound, and he's also had a successful career in scoring and licensing TV and movies. He's worked on movies like Donnie Darko, Out Cold, Orange County, She's Out of My League, Bridesmaids, Bad Teachers, Adderall Diaries, and loads of others. TV scores include Freaks and Geeks, Togetherness, Friends from College, and others. And he's got 3 solo records and loads of co-writes and production credits. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Right now.
So Gray Boy. Oh, you're welcome, man. Gray Boy All Stars, you guys play a very niche type of music. It's like funk, acid jazz, groove. How did you get turned on to this kind of music? And is this like what you listened to as a kid growing up?
No, not really. I grew up in Southern California, and like most kids growing up in the like 70s and 80s, I had older brothers listening to like Rolling Stones or Neil Young or, you know, just like the classic rock stuff. Sometimes I'd listen to like Steely Dan or, you know, like things that my older brothers were listening to, but I wasn't really turned on to any kind of like real soul music besides stuff that had hit the mainstream until I went to college and I went to school at UC Berkeley, and there was a good sort of a groove scene in the Lower Haight at the time. And so I got to hear some bands like the Meters and, you know, some more like, they're not really obscure by any means, but yeah. Like for a kid from Southern California, that was an obscure, you know, like a discovery that I made at that time. And then sort of, there was a scene in the Lower Haight where people were spinning like rare groove stuff, 45s, soul 45s, whatever. And so I got more into that. But it really wasn't until I moved back to San Diego in the early 90s where I met DJ Gray Boy, and he sort of curated the band. He was doing like acid jazz, like sample oriented records. And so he put this band together to celebrate this music that he was sampling. And we would play tracks from like Rusty Bryant or Grant Green or Boogaloo Joe Jones, the JBs, you know, stuff like that. So we'd do some tracks like that. For this party for his release of one of his records. And then we had a great time playing together, and then we just kept playing together. So
you guys are so tight.
That's how that happened.
It's amazing. So you just,
thanks.
So you really got turned on to the music by the vibe that you got created with the other band members, sounds like almost.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, yeah, it was sort of a deep dive into this stuff. You know, we weren't really trying to interpret it much. We were just kind of like, well, let's just like start by like really learning the music and really trying to understand what was happening in the music. I mean, as a kid, I was sort of very interested in rockabilly music, so I was coming from sort of like a blues and rockabilly space. So that was something that, because you remember like the Stray Cats got big in California, right? They're from California. So they got big. And, you know, anything. Well, the Stray Cats are cool, but like, what do they listen to? You know, so we're listening to like Eddie Cochran, Johnny Burnett, you know, some other kind of, you know, I don't know. There's all those sort of rockabilly style guitar players. And so I was emulating those guys. And when I heard this boogaloo music, it was sort of like, well, this was sort of like the soul version of rockabilly, right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
You know, you hear, you know, who am I thinking of? I'm spacing on his name right now. But really, what, you know, really like Boogaloo Joe Jones is not far off from a rockabilly guitar player if you really sort of like change the music that's underlying it. So anyways, I sort of had an affinity to that kind of stuff. And it was something like, oh my God, I can play this. And then having access to a great like rhythm section, like Chris Stilwell and Zach Major and Robert, and obviously playing with Carl,
yeah,
was just like, you know, I had never played with a saxophone player before. And here I am playing with this like guy who's like world-class. So it was just like, whoa, how did I get here? And this is awesome. I was just trying to keep up. At first I was just trying to keep up.
What's cool about it is you don't usually hear acid jazz like this, where guitar plays such a critical role. Or saxophone, for that matter. And yet you guys make it work, and it's great. It's really very different. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the acid jazz scene that came out, like, in the 90s out of England was sort of, like, organ-based or it was vocal-based, you know, sort of like a Jamiroquai or something, yeah, like that. Is that what you're sort of referring to? Yeah, it was kind of like a take on, like, Stevie Wonder, but with like samples and loops and things like that. Whereas we're just like a straight boogaloo band, but because we were kind of coming from the same, you know, sample, like in the same inspiration, but we, rather than like sort of being a derivative of the inspiration, we were really trying to be faithful to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you
just not really. Yeah.
Do a great job.
Thanks.
I listened to your last solo record too, Spilling a Rainbow. And a lot, mm-hmm, of pretty songs on there, but stylistically, that I wrote down, it's like you're like alt Simon and Garfunkel, because great songwriting, but it's got like, mm-hmm, this alternative slant on there. And I was wondering, are, mm-hmm, all your solo records kind of like that, or?
You know, they're, you know, I started as mainly as a songwriter, and like I started making records when I was like 17. So I started as a songwriter and a singer. And, you know, playing acoustic guitar, and I was into like, you know, Burt Jansch and Nick Drake and, you know, some of these sort of, you know, English sort of folk guys. Right. But then I sort of got into the funky stuff. And so then I sort of heard like Serge Gainsbourg and like all these sort of bands that were sort of, you know, it's just like the melding of all these things, Pentangle, where you're molding, you're putting like jazz with folk music and you know, obviously I like stuff to have a groove in a pocket. So yeah, I mean, I try not to think of it in any sort of specific genre. I just try, mm, to like combine everything I love. You know, I love synthesizers, I love jazz guitar, I love acoustic guitar, I love playing the drums. I mean, I played most everything on that record. So I'm not just a guitar player.
That's, yeah, awesome. What was your first break? Like, how'd you get started in the music business?
I got a record deal very young. I got a record deal with Virgin when I was like 21. I had a band called The Origin, and we did two records on Virgin. And that's actually where I met Carl, because I toured with Lenny Kravitz on my first album, and it was Lenny was doing Let Love Rule, and we had our first record, so we toured around with Lenny. And
wow, that's a great combo, man. I could see that, yeah, being a great show. Yeah.
that was fun. So yeah, I mean, it was, we were both on the same label, and so it was kind of like a, it was a favor thing. And I was happy that that band, I mean, that band was sort of like a, it was like my high school band, you know? And then it lasted into college, and I just got really, timing was great. I graduated from college, and I made, you know, two records that like pretty quick. I was 21 years old. So
that's really young. Was, that's amazing.
That was the beginning. And so, you know, I got, in terms of the business, I got introduced to, like, you know, we made videos, we did MTV thing. We like, I have a publishing deal, and I'd like really immersed in, I, you know, the business manager and the lawyer and the every, like everything, like all at once. And then that band kind of like, we got dropped from Virgin, and then I was just like pretty disillusioned. And that's when I went back to San Diego, and I was just like, I just want to play guitar, and I just wanted, like, I just want to play music. I don't really care about any of that anymore. And so that's when I joined the Great Boy All-Stars. And I was like, this is just going to be for fun. This will probably last a few months. Yeah. Like, I was just kind of like, I love the thing, but I was just like, this is instrumental, you know, this is instrumental music. Like, I was still coming from the mindset of, like, you know, not like a trying to be a pop star, but just like that sort of like, you know, where's your hit single?
Right.
You know, where's your release schedule? Who's your manager and all this stuff? And we were doing everything on our own. And it felt so good. You know, it felt really great. We were playing weekly. I was playing like 4 or 5 nights a week. My guitar playing was getting great. I was improvising. And it just felt right. And at that moment, I was just like, you know, it doesn't really matter. Nothing really else really matters. People are enjoying this.
Yeah.
This is like real, this is real music for the right reasons. And it proved to be the right idea, you know, 25 years later.
That's not an easy gig from a guitar standpoint by a long shot, man. It's not, you know, your solos are pretty complex there. You're playing through lots of changes. It's not easy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I really consider myself primarily like a writer and a rhythm guitar player. I like to sort of play solos, but I don't by any means shed soloistically. I don't really consider myself even a jazz guitar player. I'm just playing the music that I write and we write together. That's kind of what I'm doing. I mean, I think my ideas come through whatever they are. But yeah, I mean, it is taxing. I mean, it's physically taxing, honestly, to play, because we played like for like, you know, we would play for like 3 hours, you know, just skanking away for 3 hours, playing solo 3 hours. I mean, it was just it's hard. I mean, it's so fun, but it's intense. It's an intense gig.
It is. I could see that. And it, you know, not to blow smoke, but I think you do some great soloing on there, man. I think it comes through loud. I mean, yeah, it's primarily a rhythm thing, but you're soloing quite often, and it's very good, and it's not easy, man.
Thanks. You know, I mean, I'm mostly, you know, an intuitive player. I mean, you know, like, it was funny. We after we did West Coast Boogaloo with Fred Wesley, he's like, you know,
that's a great record. That's my favorite record. Yeah. That's such a good record, man.
Thanks. So he was like, oh yeah, you know, I remember when we were trying out guitars for James Brown's band, and I was like, yeah. He's like, you know, just gotta have a pocket. You know, you gotta have a pocket. That's what matters. And he said when he was trying out guys for James Brown's band, it was like guys would come in and he would like, okay, you know, play, you know, dun 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 dun, and guys would be like dun 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 dun, you know, like, you know, and he'd be like, no, can you play that with a pocket for 8 minutes, you know? And that's the guy that gets the gig, you know what I mean? So people, like, we're in a very like shreddy moment in music, and people often forget that, like, we're playing dance music, you know? So like, that's the primary focus, is like playing something that's danceable. That's like a celebration of the moving parts, you know, not a celebration of any one individual, you know?
It's funny you mentioned James Brown. I had a Keith Jenkins on my show. He was James's MD and guitar player for the last like 14 years of his life. And we talked about this and he said, man, you just got to sit there for like 8 minutes. Exactly. And you're playing the same groove. That's it, man. Yeah. And you better not mess up because Mr. Brown would be on your ass. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's very zenny, you know, like you're playing like a really simple figure and you're just like listening to it go by and you're like, well, I can just like not think about this for like 2 minutes, you know, and just muscle memory and just listen to the band. And then it's like, whoa, oh wait, now I got to pay it. You know, I mean, it's a mind trip, you know, to play with simplicity and intention, those are the gold elements of good music, you know.
I like what you said. It's very zenny because you can just go in there and zone out sort of and turn on autopilot for a couple of minutes.
Yeah. And listen to the band, which is what you should be doing the whole time, not just listening to yourself, but just like, how do I like, cause there's like, you know, I mean, like I remember playing when we went with Fred and we played these things and I was, you know, it's just like, I just want to like, listen, only thing I'm going to listen to, I'm not going to listen to myself for a while. I'm just going to listen to the hi-hat.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to listen to for the next couple minutes. Or I'm going to try listening to the keyboard player. That's all I'm going to listen to. I just want to fit right in with that. Just want to fit right that pocket right in there with that. You know, it's like, that's how the band starts to be like transcendent, you know, where you're just like, it's microscopic.
Well, you're fortunate because there's a lot of talent in that band in general. So you could just pick anybody there and just listen to them. Really a lot of talent.
Yeah. It's awesome.
How did you get into, this is a good story, and I hope it's the only question I'm going to ask you that you've been asked 100 times, but it's fun. I think people enjoy it. You're a successful film composer and you do a lot of licensing. Talk about how you got into that business, because I think it's a great serendipitous story that turned out to change your life, probably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we were playing in Grey Boy All-Stars and there was a moment where someone was like, oh, hey, we want to, there's someone that's asked, you know, Grey Boy All-Stars to do a movie score. And I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. You know, I never really thought about doing that. And so we did this, we got together, we wrote a bunch of cues and we went up and we did this movie Zero Effect. We kind of shared the writing duties of all the stuff, of all the music for this movie Zero Effect. Zach wrote great cues. Chris wrote great cues. Carl wrote great cues. Robert wrote great cues. And I wrote a few cues too. And I really enjoyed the process. And so I just told the music supervisor, I was like, who's the guy who sort of oversees, you know, songs and score, this guy Manish Raval and Tom Wolf. I said, you know, I really enjoyed this experience. You know, if you guys ever ever interested in asking me to do anything, I just want you to know, I really love doing it. And it was really fun. Like, you know, I'm open to doing it again. And so they called me sort of like 2 months later, for this movie, that I don't even think it really ever came out, but I made some music for this movie. It was called like Book of Adam or something. I think it was called Book of Adam. And it was cool music. I liked it. You know, I tried to make some, it was weird, like ukulele and fuzz guitar and like typewriter. It was a very sort of eccentric
kind of typewriter gives thing, a credit. You
know? Yeah. Well, you know, I was like doing percussion on typewriter. I mean, just sort of like all the quirky things, whatever. And then they took it like, oh, this is really cool. And then I didn't really hear from them for a little while. And then I heard back from them sort of like almost like a year later. And it was like, oh, the guy that you guys made Zero Effect with, he's doing this pilot. And it's called Freaks and Geeks with Judd Apatow.
Right.
And they hired a composer, but it's not working out and they need someone to like do it right now. And I was like, okay, great, I'll do it. And so then I ended up doing the pilot for Freaks and Geeks. And then I did all of Freaks and Geeks. And then while I was working on Freaks and Geeks, then it's sort of like, oh, I was asked to do Donnie Darko. And then I did Donnie Darko. And then it's just sort of like, and then you know, Jake did another movie and Judd did a movie and all these people did movie. And it was just sort of like, blah, 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 you know.
That's amazing. Kind of like, so you fell in?
Open to opportunities.
Yeah, you yeah, just
literally so, fell in.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's so cool. But yeah. But if you hadn't have gone to them and said, hey, I really enjoyed doing this, I'd love to do it again, that would have never happened.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Probably not. No, yeah. No. You know, I mean, and it's, yeah, I mean, it's a different muscle, you know, I mean, it's kind of a different way of working with music, you know.
It's really difficult because you got to work to visual cues. It's,
yeah.
And I know on Donnie Darko, I read that you were instructed to not have any guitars on that soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't want any guitar. He's like, one thing I know is I don't want any guitar. I was like, all right, well, I'm pretty much a guitar player. So I guess I didn't really even say that, but I was just like, okay, I was thinking to myself, okay, well, all right. I need to,
did you freak out? Play guitar.
Not really. I mean, you know, I mean, like anything, I just feel like I've never really freaked out, you know, you can't freak out when opportunities come your way. It's like, it's the same thing. Like when I was a kid and we were on tour and we went on tour right after we went on tour with Lenny Kravitz. We went on tour with Midnight Oil. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
That
yeah. The Australian band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time they were huge. Yeah. I mean, they were playing huge gigs and I used to start the show like with that band alone on my guitar, like just singing and playing alone. And I remember we were in New York and we played the first night with them and we'd never played in this town and we'd never played. I mean, there was, I think it was like 15,000 people or something.
Where were you playing?
It was like in Ithaca. I think it was in Ithaca.
Oh, upstate. Okay.
And the curtain went up and I was just by myself. And I say this cause it's a very similar moment to the moment where someone says like, oh, everything that you think that you are now is you just have to take it up a notch. Cause like, you have to do this thing. You're asked to do this thing and you just have to step up and do it. And in that moment, the curtains come up and there's 15,000 people there and I'm playing by myself on the guitar, you know, and I'd never done that before. So, and I just do it just yeah. Like, I just got to my piano for Darko. I just sat down at my piano and I just started writing. And I had never really written a bunch of stuff on piano before. I mean, I'd written a couple songs with my band, but like never like thematic, nothing like that.
So where did that, a lot of people can't do that. Where did that sort of like, you know, hey, I'm asked to do something. I'm going to rise above. Where do you think that comes from in you?
You know, I think it's probably has a lot to do with just, you know, growing up in a really big family and just having to like, just like muscle my way through the
you had a lot of kids?
My older brothers and sisters. I have 8 kids in my family. Yeah. So it's like,
oh my God.
Just like, I'm the youngest of 8. Yeah. So, you know, just kind of like probably just having to like get my voice heard, you know, in the context of a gigantic family.
Yeah.
And also just having to support, like having, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of people that don't get like their confidence. They just don't have confidence, you know, and decision-making, especially musical decisions, like you just have to be confident. You know, you can't deliver a musical idea if you don't have confidence. And mostly it's just being able, I think musical ideas are, they're always coming. They're always flowing. And it's the person that stops them. It's the person's doubt that stops the idea. It's not that the idea doesn't exist, you know?
Yeah, man. That's cool. That's really good. Thank you. I can't believe the youngest, God bless your parents, man. 8 kids. I have 3 and
yeah.
It was like, it's so tough.
No, I know. I have 2. It's insane.
Yeah.
It's gnarly.
It's right. Because it's not 4 times as much. It's like exponentially, like to the 4th power as much.
Well, you know, my mom was interesting. You know, she used to say that love isn't divided. It's multiplied, you know? So
yeah, good
she like, too. You know, it's like that life that was happening. It's like all these people are influencing each other and supporting each other and challenging each other. So it's, you know, it's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, man, for sure.
Yeah. And my brothers play guitar. If they didn't play guitar, I wouldn't have played guitar. It was sitting around. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll pick that up. I'll play that. I started playing when I was like 4 years old. So, well, you know, so if I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't, they weren't playing, I wouldn't be playing. So that's, I have them to thank for that.
Did any of them become professional musicians?
My brother, yeah. One of my brothers became professional. He played with like Steve Jones and Belinda Carlisle. He had he had a record deal. He's played with a lot of different people.
Sex Pistols, Steve Jones.
He's a great, yeah. He's a great guitar player. Like a real great rock and roll guitar player. You know, sort of like in the school of like a, what is the guy from UFO? He's kind of like that.
Michael Schenker?
Yeah, like a Michael Schenker or that halfway between like that and like Keith Richards.
Very cool.
Real rock and roll guy. He's great. He's awesome. And he was always like, I remember playing with him as a kid, sitting in my room, and he'd be like, you're rushing, you're slowing down, you're rushing, you're slowing down. You know, so it was like, he always like instilled like, you know, that he didn't necessarily teach me how to play by any means, because he wasn't really concerned about that. He wasn't like, you know, but he was always like this, you know, you got to care about this. It's important that you play in rhythm, you know, not just play the thing, but play it with a pocket.
Yeah.
Know?
That's
so that was big early on. That was big.
Valuable lesson. Yeah,
for sure.
How'd you wind up working with Gary Jules and writing that new arrangement for Tears for Fears and Mad World, which, by the way, my younger son turned me on to that. That is, it's almost like brings tears to your eyes every time. That's like such a moving song, man. Oh. His version.
I grew up with Gary.
Oh, okay.
And we were childhood, you know, we grew up, and he was actually in the band that I got the record deal with, but he was in an earlier incarnation of it. So he wasn't in the band that when we got our record deal.
The Origin, that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And so he was sort of in and out of that band. And then he went on, he had his own thing, and they made records. And then he started a solo career, and I ended up producing his first record for A&M. And then we were working on his second record after he was let go of A&M, and we were just working on his record called Wolf Tickets for Snake Oil, I think, or something like that. Anyway, it's on the internet. You can look it up. And so he and I were good friends, and I was working on the Darko score, and he lived down the street, and he was kind of coming over, you know, during that time. And so I was working on the film score, and sort of I had dialed in that sound, you know, the soft piano, the vocoder, the, you know, flutes and cellos and marimba and all that. After the thing and sort of thing. And I was like, well, what if I did like a John Barry on this, where it just moved from this palette of sounds from the score, and I just kind of like put it into a song, you know? And the songs had been, you know, sort of these 80s songs, you know. So these were bands that, you know, In Excess and Tears for Fears was on there, and The Church and Echo and the Bunnymen and all these bands that sort of I had grown up with. So I knew all this music. And I was always a big fan of The Hurting, which was the first Tears for Fears record. And I was like, well, what if I took one of the songs off The Hurting and I put it sort of to the score, and I sang it basically over the score, you know? And so I took Mad World and I did that with it. And I called the producer and I said, I have an idea for you. You know, I know you got, because they didn't have any money for an end title. That was the thing. They didn't have any money for an end title song. So they asked me if I could come up with something. And so I sang it to the producer, and I said, but I'm not going to sing it. I'm going to have my friend Gary sing it. He's got a beautiful voice. It's going to be great. And I sang it to her into the phone, our version of it. But it was just me and piano. just like literally with my phone like this, you know. And she was like, she's like, oh, that sounds great. That's incredible. Oh my God, you know. And so I said, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. So we did it the next day. I said, Gary, come up. Let's do this. We're going to do Mad World. It's going to like sound like the score. You can sing it super chill. It'll be really cool. And so he got in a zone and he sang it and brought it to that crazy level. And I did my arrangement under it and added cello and then added that little vocoder of put his vocal through the vocoder and it just spilled into the delay. My old, like, you know, my echo, my Roland echo. And it became like a thing. And it just like, and we were like, well, this is cool. This is a moment, you know. We kind of looked at each other because at the time we were working on his record. It was like folk, like you said, kind of like my record, like, you know, finger picking guitars, harmonies. This was something completely different, yeah, you know, for him. And so we gave it to them and it was really great and they loved it. And then there was a montage at the end of the movie in Donnie Darko and they tried to license a U2 song and they couldn't afford it. So the editor took Mad World and placed it in the montage of Donnie Darko. And he called and he was just like, you're not going to believe it. Just park the song right here and just watch it play. And it just played over the montage. And it was just like, oh, you know, yeah, just sort of this moment, you know, this, it's just saying, you know, this, you know.
And it exploded.
Yeah, well, it didn't explode at first. You know, it took a long time. I mean, I think what ended up happening is there was a guy from England that had heard it because there was a DJ that was playing it on KCRW in LA. He was a friend of Gary's, a fan of Gary's. And he was an English guy, Nick Harcourt. And he played it. And then he sent it to his friend in England. He was like, you're gonna trip on this tune. This is amazing. And so he heard it and he's like, this is a hit. This is a hit song. This will be a hit song. And then it, sure enough, I was like, yeah, whatever. Tell me a hit. Cause I don't believe you, you know, once again, like the worst, this, you know, someone told you like some slow down song from the '80s with like, you know,
yeah,
somber right. vocal on it. It was going to be a hit song, you know, you'd be like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, call me when it's number five or whatever. They did. It became number one, like all over Europe and everything. So 10.
Ah, congratulations. That's a great track, man. It's such a pretty song.
Yeah. It's a long story, but yeah, that's what happened.
But I'm just so, as I'm sitting here listening, you know, it just amazes me how for you and for so many musicians, it's almost like, you know, there's this predestined thing, and if you show up, it comes to you, and it blows my sure. mind. I mean, I've done 800 interviews almost, and
yeah.
this, you know, you're not the. I mean, this is, you know, if someone came to me and said, "How do people succeed in the music business?" I'd almost say, "Well, there's certain characteristics you got to have. You got to have a great work ethic. You know, you can't be a dick. You got to be a nice person, good hang."
Yeah.
But how do you get yeah. opportunity? Fucking show up and like if it's almost like if it's meant to be, it'll come to you. If it's not, it won't. And it's just
blows. It's kind of true, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, there is that element of just like, you know, just being open and yeah. when things kind of don't make sense. Like, you know, like I deal with it all the time. You know, like someone, hey, you know, do you want to do this show, or do you want to work with this artist? Do you want to, you know, whatever. And every time I think, well, if you really asked me if I really thought it made sense at this moment, I would probably say no. But I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
You know, and it is kind of that thing where when you try to control your life too much, it just doesn't, it sometimes doesn't work out, you know. Like if I would have said I would be a score composer and I went to score composer school in college instead
of right
studying social science, which didn't have anything to do with my thing, you know, anything to do with my, you know, it had to do with my person, like who I am, but it didn't have, yeah. I mean, these are amazing opportunities that you can't chase down.
Yeah.
You know, truthfully.
Yes.
The opportunities that are as rare as the ones that I've been afforded. You just can't go. There's no path to them. you know?
Yeah.
It's just, you know what I mean? Unfortunately, I'd like to say there is, and even people that have all the connections in the world still can't get it to happen. So yeah. It's not, there's it's like a hit song, you know, you don't, there's reasons why it happens and a million reasons why it doesn't happen, you know?
But what's interesting is that,
I wish I could tell people, you know, how to do it. I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder though, just kind of talking out loud, I've noticed this, you know, so consistently in musicians. I wonder if me just noticing, again, I'm just rambling out loud, was I didn't have that I might have had a filter on in other situations, because I wonder if everything's like that. I mean, certain things are not. Like, you become a lawyer, a doctor, you got to go to school for this, mm-hmm. and you take this test, and you work at this hospital, or you intern, you know, mm-hmm. you go and pass the bar. That's kind of scripted. But I wonder mm-hmm. if that's how everything is. I'm just kind of thinking out loud. I may be having a moment here. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the key is, like you said, work ethic.
Yeah.
And gratitude and you have to be in the moment, and you have to be open to ideas coming into you and allow them to come out, you know, just,
yes, you have to be open and you have to allow them.
You know, work at what you know to be better, but also just be open. It's just about being open.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
I mean, it's like David Lynch. I don't know if you ever listened to David Lynch and his whole like meditative trip and the whole, I saw there's a great series that Morgan Neville worked on called Shangri-La. And it's about the Shangri-La studio. And there's a moment where he's talking to David Lynch about like there's a reservoir of ideas that if you're not clear about, if your mind is cluttered, you can't reach that sort of reservoir, you know, you can't access it.
Hey, I want to talk about gear for just a couple of minutes. Are you playing flat wounds on most of the Grey Boy All-Star tracks?
Yeah, mostly.
Okay, I thought so, man, because that, you get that pop, that funk, and man, but yet you're muscling through it, which is not easy with flat wounds, man. Now I have even more respect for what you're doing.
Yeah, they're like, I mean, I learned that. I mean, I always use flat wounds, but I learned that the heavier strings are really the way to go too. Like when we played with Melvin Sparks, he was using like 14s, and I could never get to 14s, you know, on the top high.
Good Lord, man.
But I was always on I'm always on 13s on my high E. So
dude,
you get like crazy tone. Pat Martino, I heard, was used like 17s.
No, really?
Yeah.
And how does that so versus 11s? How does 13 sound different than 11s?
Just fatter tone. Fatter tone. More tension. More. You can't bend, you have to muscle it. Like you can't, you know, bang, you can't do that. And if you do, then you just gotta muscle it up to like a half step. At most, you'll get a whole step out of it.
If you're lucky, if your hands are like Iron Man or something like that. Yeah, man.
I know. It's funny.
What's your go-to guitar right now? And
For Grey Boy All-Stars, I've used a few guitars over the years. I originally started out with this Jazzmaster, actually, that's on my wall back here.
Right.
This was the guitar that I used on West Coast Boogaloo.
Okay.
And that had flat wounds. Currently, it does not have flat wounds on it. I bought this in San Francisco. but then I was like, well, you know, I want to get a jazz guitar. So then I got a Guild X175 that was like from 1965 or 66, I believe. And that had humbucker pickups in. So that immediately like Fatten the Tone. And that's like, and I use that primarily live for about 3 years. It's an amazing guitar. I love Guild guitars.
Is that like a Gibson 175?
It's like an L5, basically.
Okay.
It's a big, it's bigger than a 175. It's the big round, it's round, a round body guitar, like a round cutaway. It's not like a sharp cutaway, like a 175. And then I played, and then, and so as I've had it, so I sort of went two directions, like for the jazz sort of Grant Green kind of thing. And then I ended up getting a X175, 64, Gibson in Austin with a early patent number pickups on it. And it had the fretboard taken off of it and an ebony fretboard put on, cause the guy was a pit guitar player in Vegas, like chuck, 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 chuck. And he like ground the whole freaking fretboard off.
But dude, an ebony, ebony is so nice.
Yeah, but it had, so it was an ebony fretboard with no markers on it, no markation on it at all, no dots, nothing. So I was just like playing Great Boy All Stars tunes, just like, whoa! it was really intense, actually. And then I sort of also at the same time, I sort of had a fascination with Hagstrom guitars.
Uh-huh.
And so I started collecting those.
That's funny, you know, man. That's like metal. Those mostly metal dudes play Hagstrom.
Well, maybe, but not that. Well, you know, actually, Zappa was really into Hagstrom guitars. That was his vibe. Yeah. So Hagstrom guitars, the ones that are sort of like emulating a Stratocaster,
okay,
are amazing, super tweaky. And then of course I have a lot of guitars at this point, but then on my sort of, in my other sort of excursions through guitars, I got a, you know, I love my Fender Telecaster. I have a Maple Cap Telecaster. It's from 67.
Oh, nice.
It's wonderful. And then I also got into sort of more oddball guitars. I also play bass. So I'm also into like bass, old bass guitars. I like a lot of the German guitars. I like Hofner guitars. Okay. I like, Clira guitars. I like, what are some of the other ones I have? You know, these are sort of more like on the, these are like more like a Reichhuter or like a off brand kind of, if you're looking for like a unique tone, not a Fender tone or a Gibson tone. All right, so I have a whole series of those kind of like oddball guitars.
What do you play through amp wise? Cause I got to tell you, man, your tone is really fucking great, man.
I can actually, here, I'll show you.
Oh, cool.
I have a lot of different amplifiers. This is my amp room here at my studio. Here's a Blackface concert amp here.
Nice.
Here's my Blackface little Princeton that I love.
Awesome. That's
probably I play that the most. I love this. This is a guitar that I play a lot. Amp I play a lot too. It's a Silvertone. If you can see it, can you see it? Silvertone Twin.
Yeah.
And that has that was worked on by the guy that does Neil Young's thing. So it's got the Neil Young mod on the first channel.
Nice. So you get that. You could fuzz it out.
Yeah, I can fuzz it at that time.
That's cool.
And then my friend Eric made this little Revival amp, which is a white amp, which is really great. It's like a very early, kind of like an early Fender amp. Then I also have a little Alamo amp down there, which is great. And this also Magnetone Troubadour that I love.
So you're playing a lot of old 15 to 30 watt amps pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. And a Supro 2. I have a Blackface Super Reverb right here that I use.
Nice. Man.
There's a Versatone.
I've never heard of that.
There's a Versatone right there, which is, it's a great amp. That's a Carol K bass amp.
Oh, cool.
And then this is actually my twin reverb that I play most of the Grey Boy, most of the early Grey Boy All-Star stuff. It's a Silverface, with a drip edge 68 that's been Blackface modded.
What does that mean? A drip edge?
It means it has that like silver, it has the silver frame around the speaker baffle.
Okay. I never heard of that.
It's just a way of identifying that year. There's only like one or two years that it did that. I think it's like 67, 68, 66 Blackface, 67 they went silver, and 67, 68. And often in the Fender amps, they were using those. They were using those, using the parts from the 60s when they bought it from Fender.
Interesting. I never heard that. Right. Thanks.
Post CBS, right? CBS bought Fender. They bought all the parts and they continued to make amps, but they modified the look of them a little bit, but they were using all the parts that they bought from Fender.
Okay. Gotcha. You know? Yeah.
So they're like kind of like hybrid, and then you can mod them to be Blackface.
So you're pretty consistent in your tone of amps pretty much. I mean, they're all different, but they're all the same sort of genre.
Yeah. I also like using, like, I'll use like a Roland Jazz Chorus sometimes.
Right.
I like those. Sometimes I like solid state amps. It just depends what up. Sometimes I'll use like crappy little solid state, like Roland, like weird, like, you know, the like baby amp starter amps, you know,
yeah.
They have like built in effects or whatever. Or sometimes I'll use no amp at all. Sometimes I just like, if you want a present tone, just go direct into the board. And I mean, I have a whole recording studio here. So this sort of the gear thing expands into like the recording equipment world.
Knee jerk reaction, top three Desert Island discs just for this minute.
Just for this minute. You know, Joni Mitchell Blue is always there. Neil Young. And Grant Green live at the West End or live at the Lighthouse? I can't remember, but Grant Green live is or comes alive. Those are both amazing records.
Yeah, I like Grant Green. All righty, tough question. What do you like most about yourself? First time you've paused and like, and you haven't, you're like really quick. I'm finding myself. I got to make sure I'm quick. Cause you're quick in your thoughts. This is the first time you've paused at all.
I don't know. I don't know what I like about myself. I don't know that sometimes I like let go of like self judgment, you know, I go for it.
Wonderful. That's awesome, man.
That's also a part I hate about myself too, because sometimes I'm too quick to act. You know, I don't really filter my ideas a lot.
Well, let me add, this is an interesting one for you. Has your life been different than you imagined?
I didn't imagine it to be anything.
Thanks.
I think that's the thing that's helped me. You know, it's like not trying to imagine it. I mean, yeah. I just try not to. I try not to think too much about what it's going to be. Although I am kind of a future, like, oh, what's going to be like future, but I never like.
Wow, you sound like you're pretty present. If you've never really tried to imagine what you're, I think that's great. That's pretty healthy, man. That you seem like you're pretty present.
I mean, not to say that I don't think about the future, because I definitely do, but I don't really try to control my place in it necessarily.
Dude, that's so healthy, man. That's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah. At least on my better days. Sometimes I do, but mostly.
We all. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
You know, I like to surf. I enjoy the water. I enjoy bikes and cars and design. I'm a huge fan of architecture.
Oh, cool.
I love, like, I have sort of an obsessive compulsive relationship with architecture, and furniture and design, things like that. I mean, that's one of the things that DJ Greyboy and I really share. Besides like listening to soul jazz, we're always like, you know, looking on Craigslist for weird pieces of furniture.
What's a favorite place you've been that has the coolest architecture that you like the most?
You know, I'm sort of in sort of like, I don't know where, I don't know what the, you know, I'm more into like, I don't know if I, what I could, I guess, you know, I loved Venice. I loved part of Italy. I mean, but in terms of like modern architecture, I don't know, there's great modern architecture everywhere, but it's, you know, fits and spells all over the world, you know. I couldn't say one place. I really do want to go to Spain. I can't believe I've never been there, but I'd love to go to Spain.
It's cheap flights now.
Yeah, right.
Hey, and last question. I know you got to jump, and thank you very much for your time. And I'm so happy I got connected with your music, man, because it's really awesome. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I think I've become more positive, and more, less judgmental. I think as a less critical, I think as a person.
Is that intentional or that's just natural?
I think it's intentional.
Good for you, man.
Intentional for sure.
That's awesome. Just
try not to be a negative person.
That's great. Yeah. Hey, let me, first of all, thank you again. And, let me tell people where to find you and the band. It's a Grey Boy All Stars. Their new record is called Como de All Stars. There's also reissuing their first album called West Coast Boogaloo. And I'll tell you right now, that is a freaking amazing record. The new album's great. I was like fascinated with the first record. It was tremendous, man. I mean, it's spinning on my iTunes all the time now. And also, cool. Mike's got a few solo records out. Last one, I listened to Spilling a Rainbow. I didn't get a chance to listen to the first two. Yeah. It's a really cool record, man. He's just a really super cool songwriter. Check out all this stuff on Grey Boy All Stars, and that's Grey with an E, so it's Grey Boy, G-R-E-Y, Boy, allstars.com. And, man, thank you very much for everything. Any final words of wisdom?
No, just, you know, I don't know. Make it through the pandemic without, like, you know, I don't know. Just keep it together. Be people. Listen to reason. Listen to science. Be good to your family. I don't know.
Amen.
I don't know. Enjoy your guitar.
Yeah, man. Hang on 1 second. I'll wrap up with you, Mike. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Mike Andrews, also known as Elgin Park. Check out all his music, man. Check out the Grey Boy All Stars. I'm really confident you'll love them. And check out Mike's solo music as well. And most important, man, especially nowadays, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Mike, thanks for everything, brother. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.